hockey fans, and welcome back to RotoWire's signature NHL hockey pod, Puckcast with Statsman and AJ. Friends, I'm Paul Bruno in Toronto, Ontario, and you can follow me at Statsman22. My co-host, as always, AJ Scholes, a great follow at AJScholes24, based in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin. That's very close to our RotoWire headquarters over in Madison. On today's show, we're going to be reviewing the two conference final series that were just completed and then preview the matchup for the Stanley Cup final. Very hot, highly anticipated one, I think. But before we get there, look ahead to what you can expect after the Stanley Cup finals. We're reminding you that the hockey season now is a 365-day endeavor on the calendar, and some key dates are coming up with the NHL draft, the awards show, and, of course, free agents frenzy, where there's a lot of player movement every summer. That's kind of almost one of my favorite things to look forward to in the summer with regards to the hockey season, AJ. And part and parcel of that is going to be a bit of a coaching carousel that might take place. We've got three veteran coaches on the sidelines, and I think at least two of them are going to be snapped up. I'm talking about Babcock, Tortorella, and Barry Trotz, of course. But I want your thoughts on what might happen with those coaches and or anything that you're looking forward to after the hockey season does end.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, it sounds like there's some pretty good rumblings with Tortorella possibly to Philly, mm-hmm. which would mesh two things I don't like perfectly for me. So I would love to see Torts in Philadelphia. I can continue disliking him from that standpoint. I mean, a good coach, I can't take that away from him, but his style has kind of always rubbed me the wrong way personally. And then Barry Trotz possibly to the Jets. Seems like everybody's crossing their fingers for this kind of homecoming. He is from Winnipeg originally. So yeah, those two. And then, yeah, I guess Babcock is out there as well. I think, Jeff Blaisso from Detroit should end up somewhere pretty quickly, I would imagine, as well. So there's definitely some coaching changes to watch there. But yeah, I agree with you, Paul. The start of free agency is definitely the biggest talking point. I think it's, you know, still pushed back a little bit this year. I believe July 13th is the kickoff point there. So we got less than a month now. It's the 14th of June, so officially less than a month till that happens. So looking forward to that. But we got a Stanley Cup Finals to get through first.
Absolutely. And just teasing that topic, though, AJ, is a reminder to our listeners that we thin out our schedule in the summer months, and you can next expect to hear us, barring any shocking developments, sometime in that late July window. And we encourage you to keep an eye on our Twitter feeds and reach out to us with any questions between now and then, certainly. But we won't be on after this show for about a month. I'm going to miss you, but I will still get you on DraftKings, and we can argue back and forth and joke around with each other on the DraftKings format. So I hope a lot of our listeners have jumped to that possibility every morning, Monday to Friday. They can hear us during the offseason. I'll be switching to baseball coverage as well over there, too. So,
yeah, I mean, as I said today, you know, if people like to continue getting bad takes throughout the summer, they can take on your baseball bad takes and go from there.
They asked me who was most likely to hit a home run last night, and I said Vladdy Guerrero is on a heater. I can see it. He had three nice games on the weekend, and after a month-long slump, looks ready to go. He had three hits, including a home run late in that game. Then I picked another game, and they said, what do you think on the line here, over, under? And it was pitching duel that between Philadelphia and Miami, I think it was, and the score wound up 3-2. So I was 2-for-2 on my big predictions in my maiden voyage in baseball. So carve me if you wish, but the performance is still there. In any case, we have a couple of series to review in the conference finals, AJ, that were very different from one another. And let's begin by taking a look at the Rangers versus the Lightning. The head-to-head matchup featured the Rangers sweeping Tampa in three games and outscoring the Bolts 10-4. Tampa went through this series without Braden Point, who I understand may play in the first game of the Stanley Cup Final. We'll get back to that topic specifically a little bit later. But even though they're missing that key piece, they managed to survive the New York Rangers, who were getting outstanding goaltending. It was kind of interesting for me, AJ, and I'll flip it to you in a sec. But it was kind of interesting to me that Andrei Vasilevskiy finally got to face a goalie who was at least his equal in this set. Igor Shesterkin performed admirably at least and heroically at other times. And he was a big part of the reason why this thing went six games. We both predicted a six-game output, so I don't think either of us were really surprised. But there was a point in this series where it looked like it was the Rangers series to lose after they took the first two home games.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, you know, my initial, you know, thought around six games was that they would take one of the first two in New York, obviously, then two at home, game five dropped to New York, and then they win in game six. So not exactly when they were down 2-0, I was questioning that take, obviously, but they stormed back again, as you said, without Braden Point. Goaltending pretty solid throughout the series for the most part. And yeah, I think what we saw from the Lightning is that this is a team that's motivated to do something that hasn't happened since the early 1980s, with the Islanders going four in a row. And they're going to do everything they can to push for that third one here.
Well, and AJ, I think it's pretty obvious the turning point in this series was early on in game three, that first game in Tampa. The Rangers broke out to a 2-0 lead. So really, a lot of collars getting tight among the Tampa fan base at that point. But then Tampa got that first goal back in that game, and all of a sudden things turned. And from that point on, for me, it seemed like Tampa was building. It was like a snowball coming down the side of a hill, and eventually became a boulder and then an avalanche, let's say, ensued. let me say that. How about a twist of the words there? An interesting outcome. But I really thought that was the Rangers' opportunity to take a stranglehold, obviously, up that 2-0 in the third game. But then they just couldn't. And Tampa really showed their mettle in front of their home ice fans, that really – they really kind of squeezed the Rangers out the rest of that game, and then it was no looking back, really, without a couple of blips in the play style. But I really didn't feel like Tampa was challenged too much in terms of ultimate outcome after that third game.
Yeah, no, I mean, we talked about this a little bit. I think I brought it up on DraftKings. The Rangers had a ton of, I think if I'm remembering back, it was like 21 high danger chances through those first two games. And then the second two, you know, Tampa got the defense going and they limited them to I think it was 11 high danger chances in games three and four. Now, I haven't looked at the numbers for games five and six, but obviously you look at the shot totals being really low for those games. I mean, game six, the Rangers only put 21 shots on net. That's not going to beat Andrei Vasilevskiy. Now, it's not necessarily a volume question. I mean, Florida in their game four put 49 shots on Vasilevskiy and he didn't allow any. So getting shots is not the be all end all, obviously, but if you're only getting 21 shots, there's just not going to be enough of those high danger chances that you need to get offense against Vasilevskiy. So, you know, we will talk in a bit whether we think Colorado can do that, but obviously that was the key to the Rangers' success. And when that went away, so did the goal scoring.
And AJ, before we stop talking about the Rangers, we have to give them some accolades for really a rebuild that has taken place on the fly. And it's been only a couple of years before they have reached this point. And you know, it's easy to say, oh, they'll be back next year and probably be poised to take another step. It's awfully hard to get into the third round of the NHL playoffs. And just because you do it one year, there's no guarantee that you're going to do it multiple years in a row. So this was an opportunity lost when you think about it. But it's for a Rangers team that has a lot of pieces in place. I mean, look at their offense. They've got Zibanejad. They got Kreider, who had outstanding seasons. Artemi Panarin, who was, to me, their signature piece at the start of the season. He didn't get mentioned with the other two guys very often. He finished the playoffs with 16 points too. So three outstanding forwards. They got a couple of nice additions at the trade deadline. You wonder if they're going to keep either one. But beyond that, Adam Fox on the blue line looks to be a stud for several years going forward. And of course, they found the next goalie in the lineage that continues for the Rangers. I mean, they've gone, when you think about it, from Henrik Lundqvist to Igor Shesterkin. They're going to be looking at about a 30-year span where their goaltending has been handled by one of the very best in the game. And so that's some serious building blocks in place for the Rangers. And of course, they ran into the two-time defending champs who showed their mettle, and they were almost the equal of them through four games. But the championship caliber of that club certainly made the difference at the end of the day. On the Western Conference side, AJ, I'll leave it to you to initiate the discussion. What were your impressions of that set?
Well, I barely remember that. It's been, 2 weeks since that series ended? we were both on Colorado, and rightfully so, but to expect that to go down in just four games, I think was a bit of a surprise. You know, to me, I think it's telling that they continued to go with Mike Smith, even though, he was struggling. Mikko Koskinen has, since that series ended, I think yesterday, signed overseas. So he will not be back next year. And so it says a lot about their lack of trust in him, which is a long running issue that this team has had, is goaltending concerns. And they just weren't able to do anything against McKinnon and McCarr and the rest of that Colorado offense that is really quite good. I think obviously the biggest, question mark at one point was whether or not, losing Darcy Kuemper for the games that they didn't have him was going to impact them, extend the series, that sort of thing. And again, I kind of alluded to this. I don't know that they really needed Kuemper to be great, just good enough. And Pablo Francouz was able to be that kind of just good enough for them. And allow Nathan McKinnon and the rest of that group to go to work. I mean, you look at Francouz's numbers, 2.81 is the goals against average. I put that firmly in the good enough category when you have those offensive talents.
AJ, that's a great point, and I'm really glad that you mentioned that, because Francouz, like you said, didn't have to be lights out, but it just speaks to the value of a competent second goalie. And in Edmonton, they just lost the complete trust of Mikko Koskinen, so it's no surprise that he saw fit to leave, and leave very quickly after the season wound up, because you knew that he had soured on the organization just as much as they soured on him. I mean, in a different light, you might say Mike Smith's a 40-year-old goalie. He's certainly not going to be there for the long haul, and he may be even in a position to call it quits as a career any day now for what we know. We've heard some indication that he's contemplating that possibility. So if Koskinen was of another mindset, he could have said, I might try to stick around here and make a case to be retained. But that just wasn't in the cards, it didn't seem. And it was very telling for me that he left as quickly as he did. Now the Oilers have to be looking at their offseason and saying, we got to get a quality netminder in place. There are certainly a couple available, and it'll be a subject we can knock around if we want later, or certainly on a subsequent show. But for now, I have to think that that's a priority in the offseason for Edmonton to address that situation. I mean, you're hearing that Jack Campbell is available in Toronto and going to test the free agent market. You're hearing that maybe the goalie in Anaheim, John Gibson, is going to be up for trade, even though he has a significant cap hit remaining for 3-4 years on his deal. That's just a couple of the pieces that are out there in the net minding bidding wars that are surely going to ensue later this summer. But in terms of what happened in this series in the playoffs for Edmonton, you've got to be just so pleased with the output you got from McDavid and Draisaitl, averaging better than two points a game. It's throughout the playoffs. It's been a long time since a couple of players did that for a losing team after three rounds in a playoff. I can't recall one for sure. And you wonder what happens to a guy like Evander Kane. He did certainly show enough to merit some consideration in free agency going forward. He got a pretty good opportunity in Edmonton, and you wonder if he feels loyal to the organization. He got 13 goals, 4 assists, and 15 playoff games this season. They got great mileage out of Zach Hyman in year one of his contract with 16 points in 16 games. And Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, underrated though he might be in some quarters, almost a point per game guy as well. So they too have a lot of pieces in place, and they're in a pretty soft division, AJ. So the future it should be bright for this team, but they got to solve the situation in that.
Yeah. I don't think there's more of a breakdown we need there, Paul. I think you covered it pretty well.
Thank you.
Edmonton's biggest concern going into the season for me was goaltending, and coming out of the season remains goaltending.
Absolutely, my friend. Well, you know what? We covered off both series. By the way, we both were on Avalanche in this set, and I would have taken them quickly if I'd known that they were going to be facing an Edmonton team that was going to get very poor, inconsistent goaltending, worse than I thought they were going to get. I thought they would outscore the Avs in a couple of games, and so did you. But instead, it wound up being a sweep. So we were on the right teams. We just didn't have the right game length. But no surprise to either one of us in terms of what to expect in that Stanley Cup final in terms of a matchup. We got what we figured, and we'll be back to talk about that as after we take this break, and we'll take a look at the Stanley Cup final predictions and also a couple of other housekeeping issues with the trophy winners that have been announced and trophy winners to come. You're listening to Puckcast with Statsman and AJ, and we'll be back right after these messages.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
All right, we're back and ready to...
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Take a look at that Stanley Cup final between Colorado and Tampa. AJ, why don't you tee it up in terms of what happened in the regular season between these teams and your early observations overall?
Yeah, I mean, you look at it here. Colorado had the edge here, I believe, in their two limited matchups, 2-0, a 4-3 win in Tampa, and then an OT winner, 3-2. At home in Colorado there. So just a slight edge. I mean, we're talking one goal games, limited opportunities to play each other. So really There's not too much we can really take from the regular season series, you know, unless you really want to point to the Avs winning both, but they were tight, close games. And so, yeah, I'll dive us in right into the goaltending matchups here. On one side, we have, you know, no question who's going to be starting. Andrei Vasilevskiy continues to roll. He's been doing this kind of weird, like, slump tear thing, right? Like, he had a couple of rough games against Toronto, then seemed to turn it around and, you know, just completely dominated Florida. Then has the rough first game against the Rangers. Second game looks a little bit better, and then again turns it on from there. So from that standpoint, maybe you should be expecting Colorado to kind of get a few goals in this first game later on today, or tomorrow rather. And then, you know, from there, maybe Vasilevskiy turns it on, because that's what we've been seeing so far. On the flip side, we really unfortunately have to say we don't know who's going to start at this point. You know, we can give you the reasons each one will go. Darcy Kemper was their starter during the regular season, went 37-12-4, 5 shutouts, 2.54 goals against average. His numbers in his playoff games aren't terrible. They're certainly solid. You've got, let's see, playoffs 6-2, 2.65 is goals against average. But while he was hurt, Pavel Francouz comes into the game after it already started, but was officially credited with the win in game one against Edmonton based on when he took the ice. So wins 4 games in a row. Again, really solid numbers for him throughout. So I don't know. Do you go back to your starter because he's your starter? He's the guy you trusted at day one of the playoffs and throughout most of the regular season. Or do you ride the guy who just won 4 games in a row for you and is really, you know, in showing some improvement and you don't want to rock the boat? So I think they have a tough choice on their hands here. If I had to guess who would start, I would maybe guess Kemper. If I had to pick who would start, if I was the coach, I would probably go with Francouz. So take that for what it's worth. But that's the goaltending matchup as I see it, Paul.
That's very interesting that you put it that way, AJ. And I was waiting for you to see if you would cover it off, and you did a beautiful job on the goaltending situation. The only thing I'll add is that Vasilevskiy has to be in the heads of Colorado thinking, this guy's done it. How many series in a row? That's 11 in a row that he's won. And certainly the defending champ as far as the Conn Smythe Trophy for playoff MVP, he's in line possibly to do it again based on what he's doing in this postseason. I mean, he hasn't had the number of shutouts that he's had in prior years, but he's come up large when this team needed to, and certainly kept them in series when it looked like they might not otherwise be. So he certainly helped them hold serve when needed, they needed, and certainly delivered the games that they needed to have when they needed a goaltending gem. In terms of the goaltending on the other side, for my money, I think I would go with Darcy Kemper, AJ, just because, like, and you said it very well, he was the number one guy at the beginning of the season. He was the number one guy at the beginning of the playoffs, and he's healthier now than he was in the last series, obviously, and ready to go by all accounts. So I think the play is to get Kemper in there in game one and see if he can build something here in the final series and live up to that number one billing. Otherwise, they have a viable option in game two. Should they lose game one, I think it's an easy switch to Pavel Francouz in game two. So they have an option there. But very, very odd pairing of goaltending situations. One couldn't be more different than the other. Not to say that either one's bad, though, because Colorado's guys have been really good, as you suggested. How about the blue lines, AJ? What do you see on the Colorado blue line that you really like?
Well, I think obviously Cale Makar, right? Like second in defenseman scoring during the postseason here, 5 goals, 17 assists. They're getting really good production out of Devin Taves as well. He's got 13 points, so just shy of one a game. And that's, you know, that's the kind of primary driver here. Bowen Byram has looked decent, 7 assists in his playoff experience. His minutes are up. With Samuel Girard being out, he's kind of consistently, you look early on in the Nashville series, he's pushing about 14, 15 in that range. And then during the Edmonton series, he's closer to 20. So getting some more ice time, I think that's good for him. He's an offensive player. And then going, you know, as I jokingly like to call them, with the Johnson brothers on kind of a more defensive side. And then Josh Manson rounding out the group. So I like the fact that they have a stud in Cale Makar, but they're not entirely dependent on him solely for the scoring. The fact that they have Devin Toews, who can also do that. Bowen Byram has chipped in some offense here or there as well. And then several really quality shutdown guys and some depth. I mean, Ryan Murray could get into a game. He's certainly capable. Curtis McDermott, another guy capable of logging, you know, in that 15-minute kind of shutdown defensive role. So I really like Colorado's blue line. Paul, how do you compare it to the Tampa blue line?
Well, I love that you pointed out the depth here in Colorado's case, and the same applies to Tampa. And the playoffs are a war of attrition, and you need 7, 8, 9 guys that have the NHL experience, or you trust a young rookie or AHLer in this role. Colorado certainly has that, and I think it's obvious that Tampa has too. They certainly are going to roll behind Victor Hedman, who is arguably the best defenseman in hockey any year, and certainly he's been challenged in that regard. I don't think he's going to win the Norris this year, AJ, but he's in the discussion as well. He's that good, that consistent. Statistically, he's coming off his best year in the regular season of his career, and he's kept it up in the playoffs. He's just a stud who eats up a lot of minutes and plays in every situation for them, but he's ably supported. He's partnered with Jan Ruta, who is kind of the no-name defensive stay-at-home type who guards, binds the store when Hedman and goes up the ice. And so he's a good foil for him because he's an experienced hand. Then the second pairing, they've got a guy who was a former captain of the aforementioned Rangers, Ryan McDonough, who's manning the second pairing. And I don't think he gets his due, AJ. He's so much in the shadow of several other players in Tampa, but he's such a quality player. He was known for his offensive game and his defensive game in New York, but he's playing in the shadows of Hedman and doesn't get the credit that he did, that maybe he is due for what he's doing for this team. More in a defensive role, obviously, in a shutdown pairing with Eric Chernak, Chernak is a giant of a defenseman, mobile for his size, and another quality defensive defenseman. So they got two good offensive pieces, and I would say 4 quality defensive-minded pieces among the top 4 defensemen. They rounded out with Mikhail Sergachev, who had a bit of a coming-out party in the last series, AJ, with a couple of key plays in a decisive game, showing off his offensive abilities as he managed to get pucks through. And the way that he did it wasn't with the big slapper, too. I'll point that out. And there's a lot of people that malign some of the defensemen that play the point in the NHL, blue line in the offensive zone, because you don't see the big slappers anymore. But the key is to get the puck on the net in traffic, and good things happen. And he was involved in a few of those plays, decisive ones. And they round up the six-pack with Zach Bogosian. This guy is such a hard rock, a quality defensive defenseman that's also a good foil for Sergachev. So the makeup of their top 6 is outstanding. They've got 3 quality offensive pieces, and like I said, every one of them can play the defensive side of the puck. Maybe Sergachev, the weakest of the 6-pack in that regard, but in their own end, it's awfully hard to get good quality chances on Vasilevsky when this group is on. And they rounded out with reserves like Cal Foote and Darren Radish, who has had a cup of coffee in the NHL. But Foote comes from a great hockey legacy in his family, and so you know he plays the game well in the back end too. So I don't know if you see anything decisive, AJ, in terms of the defense matchup in this series. I'm going to call it even, but I'm going to also give you an opportunity to maybe share your grade in terms of an analysis here.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've slightly favor Colorado here only because, you know, you mentioned McDonough's offensive upside. We haven't really seen that in the postseason, much more defensively minded. I will say it evens out for me more if Sergachev can play the way he did in the last 2 games that he does, you know, heading into this next series, because his playoffs was really quiet, and it made for them to have pretty much, they were much more of a headman and then nobody else from an offensive standpoint. So if they can get a little bit from Sergachev heading into the finals, if he's got some momentum here, I think that could be a game changer for them and really even things out.
About on the offensive side, AJ, I'm going to lead us into the discussion with Colorado's makeup and then leave it to you to come back with what Tampa's going to counter with. But The Avalanche have shifted things around. We've been used to seeing the big three up front, Mikko Rantanen with McKinnon and Landeskog on a top line. They've just had to shuffle things around because they're dealing with a key injury on their team, and that's Nazem Kadri with a thumb that was, I think, broken surgically repaired during the second round of the playoffs. So there's some uncertainty about his availability with the start of the Stanley Cup final. That could really tip the scales too when you think about the fact what Kadri's meant to this team at both ends of the ice, but primarily offensively in that second line center role. They've had to shuffle things up and they've had to break up that top line. The beneficiary from the DFS standpoint is Valeri Nichushkin. He's had a very good playoff season so far and a pretty good season in the NHL as well, maybe his best as a pro, fitting in very nicely here wherever they put him. And now he's in a great spot for DFS players as the first line right winger. And Mikko Rantanen instead drops to that second line. They put him in at center ice, AJ. I'm curious to see how this works out. Flanked by Arturi Lehkonen, an addition from Montreal at the trade deadline, who's performed well for this club. And Andrei Burakovsky, an underrated guy who's a very capable scorer and is maybe the shooter on the second line unit here. Third line, they've got an interesting mix. Alex Newhook getting promoted after a couple of so-so years. He's getting a chance to get a look at the top nine on a regular basis. JT Compher's had a very nice playoff for this team. And Nicholas Ovechkin is the guy that rounds out the third forward unit. Then it goes to Jason Megna, Darren Helm, Logan O'Connor as your fourth line. These guys probably won't play much more than 5 to 7 minutes a game, but Helm is a guy that could provide some quality minutes if they need to shuffle things up on that third unit. So I like the makeup of the top six, but it'll be a lot different story for me if Nazem Kadri can come back early in the series and resume his role. And then what does it do to the rest of the lineup here? They really will miss him no matter what, if he's out for a couple of games. So very strong offense. They'll come at you in waves when they're playing the best hockey. I'm curious to see how they match up to what the defense that Tampa will put up. But what about the Tampa offense, AJ? How do they counter what Colorado's throwing up?
Well, it starts with the potential addition. The first thing we should point out, no pun intended, is the intentional return of Braden Point. At initial most recent practice, they had him on a third line with Ross Colton and Nick Paul. I kind of thought if he came back, they'd stick him back in the top six right away. So probably a wait and see game, whether that means he'll play game one in a third line role or if they're just using that to kind of ease him in and they'll wait to use him in game two. Could still be up in the air as they figure out how he's dealing with that injury. But as it stands right now, based on those line combinations, we'll have Palat, Stamkos, and Kucherov in the top line. And really just, I think that matches up really well with Colorado's group, a couple studs and kind of a plugger, if you will, not to say bad things about Palat there, but when you're playing with Stamkos and Kucherov, that's kind of your role. Then they've got Brandon Hagel, who they added at the deadline, Anthony Cirelli and Alex Killorn as the second group. Again, maybe not the same talent level as having, Rantanen in that center role, but certainly a capable trio. I mentioned the third line already, and then you get a fourth line of Patrick Maroon, Pierre-Édouard Bellemare, and Corey Perry with Riley Nash potentially waiting in the wings as an addition there. And that's just a gritty, tough veteran line to play against. I mean, we talk about this team going third for its third straight Stanley Cup. Patrick Maroon is going for his fourth straight Stanley Cup. So, I mean, this is a guy that knows how to win. I think in terms of that line, you absolutely give the edge to Tampa in terms of the fourth line. Even if Andrew Cogliano's back from his injury, he seems less likely to play game one, maybe a little bit later. He would kind of add some of that physicality to the Colorado fourth line. But even if he's there, I think this is a mismatch for them here. So a lot of it depends on who's healthy, who's not. I think Point gives them a better third line. But as you said, if Nazem Kadri's back, then that shuffles up the first line and second line. So overall, I think these forward groups are generally pretty evenly matched.
They are, but I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to give Tampa a very slight edge, and it's basically mostly on the backs of the bottom six forwards here. You mentioned rate and points and pending return. That's a huge boost to that team. Ross Colton and Nick Paul particularly have had very good playoffs for them, so it's a solid third line. I have some misgivings about Colorado's third line, so I think Tampa gets the edge there. And then there's a clear advantage to me for the fourth line that Tampa's going to throw out, even though they're only going to play 5 to 7 minutes. Maroon and Perry have been noticeable, along with Belmare, in every game that Tampa's won. They've had a piece of that, those wins too. So they're getting a lot of mileage out of the bottom six, and I think that might be it. It's the thing that tips the scales, because I think top six on each side are quite comparable when you think about the overall skills. Probably the two-way game of Tampa is a little stronger than what Colorado offers, but Colorado's firepower a little bit stronger than what Tampa offers in that top six. So overall, I'm going to give a very slight advantage, just because I think the bottom six for Tampa is going to be a factor in this series. So check mark there. I got it even on the blue line, and I got Tampa winning in the net. So you can I'll tip my hand now, AJ. I'll go first in terms of the ultimate outcome. I'm curious to see what you say. But I think the champs are poised for a three-peat. I'm picking Tampa in six games to win it on home ice. The two regular season games that they played against one another were both Colorado wins. But interesting to note that they scored a total of six goals over those two games. And I think if you told the Tampa coaching staff that they would be in games with Colorado where they'd keep them to an average of about three goals a game, they'd think, we have a shot. We have a real shot here. But if Colorado's offense goes unchallenged like they did in so many other games in the regular season, that's Colorado's big advantage. If their offensive firepower can outshoot what Tampa's defensive approach brings to the table, then you can make the case for Colorado. I just won't. And I think defense wins championships, and Tampa's going to get their third in a row.
Well, I've avoided answering this question at any point because I'm back and forth on it. In fact, if you head over to RotoWire and check out the latest NHL bets article that I put together there, I have my NHL best bet for Avalanche Lightning, and it's Tampa Bay plus 1.5 games at minus 130, which means the Lightning don't have to win for you to cash. Colorado also doesn't have to win for you to cash. There's scenarios where either team could win and you cash in on that bet. So I guess it's time for me to put the rubber to the road. And Paul, because you're on Tampa, let's do this. Because you're on Tampa, I will go with the Avs. I'm going to say the Avs in seven. Okay. They're going to need their home ice advantage here. I am really not sold on that. In fact, if you ask me tomorrow, I might be on Tampa. The goaltending is huge. Andre Vasilevsky is the biggest thing here, but I like the offense. I think Colorado knows that this is their chance. This is their opportunity. Getting three in a row, like I said, it hasn't happened since the Islanders did four in the 80s. They're going to be hard pressed to do it. So mostly because it's more interesting if we're on opposite teams for the rest of the series, Paul, I'm going to take the Avs in seven, at least for the next 15 minutes.
All right. Very good. Well, I'm glad we're on opposite sides, because then we have something to talk about on our next episode, AJ. And so basically that's the coverage that we're going to do for the playoffs. But there's been some news about trophies handed out and some trophies yet to be handed out. So I want to address that now, AJ. And we'll start with the ones that have been handed out already, beginning with the Jack Adams Award. Daryl Sutter, doing an outstanding job in Calgary, wins it over Andrew Brunette and Gerard Gallant. Are you okay with this decision? Any comments?
Yeah, I think it's fine. I mean, I'm going to be blunt about this. The Jack Adams has been ruined for me. You have the winningest coach in Penguins history has never even been nominated for it. So at this point, it's a garbage trophy as far as I'm concerned. They don't give Mike Sullivan enough credit. You know, they just want to say, oh, well, he coaches Crosby and Malkin, and so it doesn't matter. Like, those guys have been injured for huge chunks of the season. You know, he coaches a phenomenal team. So I honestly couldn't care less about this award anymore. Because I don't think the right people necessarily get nominated for it.
No, I think you certainly make the case for him over Andrew Brunette to be included in this mix. Brunette had a pretty good team in Minnesota handed to him and did a nice job there for sure. But I think Pittsburgh's coach did an outstanding job, to your point, and should have been the third guy in this mix. I have no quarrel with Gerard Gallant, who's been a fine addition behind the bench in New York, and certainly Daryl Sutter. We know what he's all about. He's also a great coach. So I'm thinking that had a lot to do with his winning this award with Calgary's outstanding season, the biggest part of that equation. The Masterton Trophy, AJ, that's one where I think I have a little bit of trouble with the way this thing turned out. Carey Price won it over Kevin Hayes and Zdeno Chara. You can certainly make the case for all three men. I wouldn't have picked Carey Price to win this one. I would have given it to the big defenseman on the island myself.
Yeah, I might have gone with Kevin Hayes, just everything he had to play through sure. This year off the ice and dealt with some injuries too and stuff like that. But I don't have an issue with the three guys that were nominated by any stretch of the imagination. I think they all were deserving in their own ways in their own right.
I would have ranked them Chara first, Hayes second, and Price third for my money, and I won't get into reasons why, but I think that was a slight against a guy who's been a soldier in this league for two decades and never really embarrassed himself, and I'll leave it at that. Frank Selke, the best defensive forward in the NHL, Patrice Bergeron over Alexander Barkov and Elias Lindholm. You could make a great case for all three of these guys, but I think they might have to consider renaming this award the Patrice Bergeron Award when he retires.
I mean, Paul, you took the words out of my mouth. Like, the guy can't win it this many times without them. You know, maybe if they want to hyphenate it, like the Selke Bergeron Award or something. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
we don't need to get too cute with it. But look, I will just say, for a generation of fans my age, you know, I don't really know who Frank Selke was. So to rename it Bergeron makes sense to me. That's not a slight to, you know, older NHL fans who might have a more vested interest in that. But it certainly makes sense to me to consider some sort of hyphen or rename situation, because this is a guy that just continues to win the trophy. It's basically his.
That's true. And for people of another generation, Frank Selke Jr. was an off-ice key to the success of the Montreal Canadiens of a bygone generation. And the name is synonymous with success in the hockey history annals of the early part of the first 50 years. Well, the first 50 years of the NHL, he was a significant participant in those. Lady Bing Award, the best, the most gentlemanly player. The guy basically plays a clean game and is a high scorer and or very key defenseman. And it's interesting that a couple of defensemen got into the mix here in terms of the final three, AJ. It's been a long time. I don't think I can ever recall when two defensemen were among the three nominees. You expect the defensemen to get in the way of forwards and get a number of penalties just because of that, the odd trip or hold or whatever. But Jacob Slavin in there for the second year. No, he won it last year. And Jared Spurgeon, a guy who was smallish in stature and manages to play with a high offensive upside and yet very strong defensive acumen. They made the list here, but the winner was Kyle Connor, who had an outstanding offensive season and doesn't really get too much involved in stupid activity on the ice or even unusual penalties. He keeps the penalty minutes low, and yet he did enough to almost score close to 50 goals this season. So I think you can make a case for all three of these guys, but Kyle Connor certainly a deserving candidate in my mind.
Yeah, to your point about the defensemen, only four defensemen have actually ever won the Selke Trophy. Red Kelly obviously did it, you know, multiple times, but if we're counting him as just one, then yeah, really limited. So to have two guys in the mix, but Kyle Connor took one penalty this year, one minor penalty. Like that's just ridiculous to do, that your stick gets in somebody's skate. Like somebody sticks on your stick, you usually get called for a trip.
Yeah. Right.
The fact that Kyle Connor didn't even have that happen to him, more than one time is just says a lot about how he plays the game. And so I think he was the perfect perfect winner for this award. I'm sorry, he had four penalty minutes. I should clarify. He had two penalties.
Yeah, boom.
Two penalties, 4 minutes. So, yeah, I think certainly very deserving, especially for a guy who almost put up 100 points.
AJ, those are the awards that we know about right now. There's going to be four more at least handed out between games three and game four of the final. I guess there's a couple more too after that with the Ted Lindsay Award voted on by the players. But we'll cover off the other four major awards now and get your slant on the finalists that have all been revealed. I'll give the thumbnail on the James Norris Trophy with three defensemen, Victor Hedman, who had, as I said, his best offensive season of his career with 85 points in 82 games and a plus 26. Roman Josi led the Nashville Predators with 96 points in 80 games, plus 13. And Cale Makar, in 77 games, compiled 86 points and an incredible plus 48 mark there. You can make the case for all three of these guys, AJ. I'm going to say that Roman Josi wins this award based on that ridiculous point total. He almost became one of the rare breed of hockey players, 100-point scoring defenseman in hockey history. And he did it on a team where he was the leading scorer on this club. So you can't say he relied on the offensive help provided by teammates of Hedman and Makar in their respective situations as much as Josi did driving the bus in Nashville. And that's really why I give them my vote for the Norris to Roman Josi. I'm curious to see if you disagree.
I would go with Cale Makar. In part because of that plus minus number. And the reason I point that out is the fact that 34 of his 86 points were scored on the power play. You don't get a plus on a power play goal or point or whatever. So the fact that he has the best plus minus of all these guys, he's second in the point total. I think he edges out, you know, we can't just, you know, if we want to make it the opposite of the Hart Trophy for, you know, guy who has the most points wins the goal and wins the trophy, we can do that. But I think the plus minus here being so astronomically higher than the other two, I mean, it's almost, it's like three times Josi's, you know, almost double Hedman's, I think gives the edge to him in my opinion.
And take us through the Vezina candidates there, Cody.
Yeah, so Igor Shesterkin led, the save percentage and goals against average at 2.07 and 9.35. UC Saros led the way in wins with 38, and then Jacob Markstrom led the way in shutouts with 9. So each of the three candidates leading in one category or another. For my money, I go with Markstrom. The 9 shutouts is kind of the difference maker when you figure he was second in save percentage, second in goals against average, first in the shutouts, and then just behind Saros in the wins. I also, you know, I know it's not really Shesterkin's fault because he got hurt a little bit, but he did not play as many games as the other guys here. Now, that could have helped his win total and maybe his shutout total. So, you know, but the fact that he only played 53 to the 63 and 67 for Markstrom and Saros respectively, I give the edge to Markstrom, but I think all three really are good candidates here.
Yeah, this is probably going to be one of the closest votes from the first to third, AJ. I'm going to opt for Shesterkin to get the nod. He was also nominated for the Hart Trophy, just to tell you how valuable he was to the New York situation with the Rangers. He had the best a save percentage and the best goals against average among these three guys. And they were probably tops in the league overall for players that played a certain minimum number of games as well. So to me, I think Shesterkin's going to win this one. And so we're two for two in terms of disagreeing, but I wonder if we're going to find a consensus here when we get to the Calder Trophy. And I'll describe the candidates, AJ, Michael Bunting, 25, 26 years of age. So a lot of people have an issue with the fact that a guy of that age gets a chance to be in the running, but they amended the rules so that I think that's the cutoff almost at that age, because several years ago, Igor Larionov won it when he was in his 30s. So Bunting, for his part, though, got a real good assignment to play with Matthews and Marner in Toronto, and he made the most of it offensively to lead the league among first-year players with 23 goals, 40 assists for 63 points, plus 27. much higher than the other two guys. Again, possibly more a function of who he was playing that with than the situations that the other two players found themselves in. Moritz Seider, look, I had to laugh in the exhibition games when I heard about this guy because they were Detroit pundits were touting him as the next Nicholas Lidstrom. And I'm thinking, okay, slow your roll, folks. This guy hasn't played a game yet in the NHL. But when I got a look at him, the size was there, the physicality was there, and then he started to play and produced 50 points in his first season as a pro. 82 games played. He didn't miss one. He had a minus nine, but that was a function of being on a terrible team in Detroit that was up against some of the toughest teams in hockey in that division. So an outstanding season for him by any standard. When you look at what he was up against and the fact that he produced so much offense, was a real eye-opener for me in that Detroit circumstance. Then we got the highlight reel waiting to happen. That's Trevor Zegras. Of course, he scored a couple of Michigan goals, was involved in several highlight reel plays all season long in Anaheim, and he's going to be the flag bearer of this team's fortunes over the next several years, I think. But in year one, the first complete season that he had, 75 games played, 23 goals, 38 assists, 61 points, a minus 21, bit of a blight when you consider the plus minus was so poor. But he, like I said, was fun to watch and certainly productive offensively. AJ, I'm giving this award to Moritz Seider. I don't think it's going to be close. I think he's going to win it by a pretty good margin because of the positioning plays and how he did it with the physicality and the offensive upside that he showed on a team that was an also-ran in the NHL.
Man, I just assumed we'd be on opposite sides. I assumed you were going to go with Bunting here, you know, because he's a Leaf and why wouldn't you? But I agree with you on Seider, and in part because one thing you didn't mention, 21 power play points for Seider as well. So definitely producing. That's the most of any rookie in the league ahead of, you know, teammate Lucas Raymond and Trevor Zegras, who had 17 power play points as well. So while his point total is not as high, I think the fact he played all 82 games, he does have a good, solid, you know, power play base here as well. I think you can overlook a minus nine that's not drastically skewed in either direction. So I will agree with you on this one, Paul. Moritz Seider.
All right, my friend, give us the thumbnail on the Hart Trophy candidates, and then I'll tell you who I think is going to win.
Yeah, we've got your fella, Austin Matthews, 60 goals this year, 106 points overall. Then, of course, Connor McDavid is here, played 80 games this year, led the league with 123 points, including 44 goals. And then, as you mentioned, Igor Shesterkin, the netminder in the mix for this as well. I think for me, it's probably pretty clear that Shesterkin is probably out as far as the Hart goes. I guess maybe if they give the Vezina to Markstrom or somebody else, but I don't see them giving Shesterkin both the Vezina and the Hart Trophy. I just don't see voters going that way. So I think for me, it comes down to Matthews and McDavid. And as you know, Paul, I have long held to the theory that McDavid is not the most valuable player in the league. He is the best player in the league. I will not argue that. I just don't think he is the most valuable player, as he, you know, if they lose him, they still have Draisaitl. So for me, I think it's Austin Matthews for the win. I think overcoming his loss, while Toronto does have some capable players on the team that would potentially step up if he was out, you know, Tavares, Marner, Nylander, I do think he is the most valuable player on his team and therefore should be the most valuable player in the league based on this trio that was nominated. As you know, I still believe the most valuable player in the league is Nathan MacKinnon, and he should have been nominated here and should have won. I will stand by that. I will plant my flag on that one forever. But among the three options, Austin Matthews.
Yeah, I think that MacKinnon should have been in there ahead of Shesterkin as well. I agree with you. But even so, I would give the award to Matthews just because of that very rare plateau. He reached 60 goals. We haven't seen that for many years. And that just told part of his story. He developed a 200-foot game. He was a physical force. We saw that in the first round against Tampa, where he was among the leading physical players in terms of hits that were made, and he got in the way of a lot of shots too. So showing the development of a 200-foot game I still don't think you can say that about Connor McDavid, even though the plus minus favors McDavid. I think Matthews showed better in terms of the overall game between the two guys. And I stress again, this is a regular, all these awards are voted on based on regular season play. If you incorporate what happened in the playoffs, McDavid wins this in a runaway, I think. But based on the regular season, I'm taking Austin Matthews too. So basically, AJ, we agreed on two of them. We disagreed on two others. And that's kind of a neat way to wind things up in terms of the coverage of our seventh year on this August program. We're going to remind our listeners, we're not going to do a DFS segment. There's only one game. The series starts tomorrow, and we didn't feel it was appropriate to do that. We might throw one in there. We won't get a chance to throw any more in there. So we want to thank FanDuel and DraftKings for their support of our work this season. And we'll remind you that we have a couple of upcoming dates to keep an eye on. The amateur draft, 7th and 8th of July. Free agency signing period, July 13th is when it starts. And I'll be all over my Twitter feed trying to find out which insiders that I follow will break some stories there. And I might like to stay on the patio and watch my TV outside with the great coverage we get in Canada of that first day, because it's always a lot of fun. But AJ, it's been my pleasure to work with you on our sixth year together on this broadcast. And this is a good time for me to say thank you for what you bring to the table every week. Been a lot of fun working with you. And do you have any closing thoughts before we call it a season?
Well, just echo thanks for you leading the way on this. You do all the hard work. I just show up and talk. I want to thank all of our listeners out there, everybody who tunes in, watches. You know, these last ones in the playoff have been online. So watches online, tunes in, whatever platform you check us out in. And you'll still find plenty of hockey coverage over at RotoWire over the summer. I'll be doing some more soccer work over the summer as well and heading into next year. So you can check that out. Paul's doing baseball for us and over on DraftKings as well. So we'll be around. There'll be plenty of stuff for you to find and just enjoy the NHL playoffs. But thanks first and foremost for listening to us ramble on every week about our favorite hockey topics.
Excellent words, AJ. Well said. In the meantime, as always, please remember to send your comments or questions on Twitter anytime. Follow me, Paul Bruno, at Statsman22, and you can follow AJ at AJSchultz24. So long, everybody. Have a great summer.